Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Judy Collins is our guest this hour to discuss her latest book, Cravings, How I Conquered Food. She has now overcome alcoholism and a long-term serious eating disorder. In her latest book, she writes about both, takes us through her childhood as well as the story of her ever-so-successful professional life and her very difficult personal life. She's recorded more than 50 albums, helped launch the careers of Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen, Randy Newman, and others by singing their songs. She's also a songwriter and has written many books. I've interviewed her several times on many of her extremely personal books. She is still touring with about 130 shows a year, and she had a Grammy nomination this year for Best Folk Album. She is one voracious reader. Who else would go way back to Hippocrates to get his advice about healthy eating? She's an activist and a very honest human being, and we're delighted to have her with us. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. But we need to start with a song.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see.
Judy Collins, thank you so much for being with us. You sing that song better than any human being I know. I just love it. It's so good.
Thank you so much, and thanks for playing it. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I've played it many, many times. Our phone connection is a little strange. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can okay. hear you. What about me?
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, it's not terrific, but it's okay. Well, you've done it again. You write so incredibly honestly. It just is remarkable to me. You will touch so many people because so many people have gone through all of these food issues. I knew you had struggled with alcohol. I had no idea your long and very devastating struggle with food.
Yeah, I'm a multitasker. As
I guess you are.
Yes, well, the food started very young, and of course it went on and on and on, and after I got sober, it got worse. And, but I got abstinent from bulimia after 11 years in 1982. So things have been much better, and then I had a really terrific I would say, solution that was I found, and it was so wonderful that I have to share it with everybody.
All right, and we will talk about the solution. You grew up in a family, and I did too. My father was a sugar broker, of all things. So we used to go and distribute cotton candy at the grocery stores on Saturday mornings.
God.
But we
heaven,
have a
heaven.
Yeah, we also had a history of some alcoholism in my family, and this whole thing about sugar and alcohol, there's a connection here.
Oh, there is for sure. And, of course, my solution in my food plan that I talk about is don't eat sugar, grains, flour, wheat, and corn. I mean, those are the wicked foods, and funnily enough, they're also in alcohol. So we stay away from them.
And those are the foods that your mother made for you very well all the time when you were growing up.
You know, my mother was a wonderful cook, and she was a very balanced cook. And I was talking to my sister about this, and she said, we didn't have dessert all the time. We didn't have things all the time. They were really kind of ladled out in the way that was moderation. And in my mind, I had sugar all the time. So it's good to have a relative to get the story straight.
Mm-hmm. Yes, go ahead.
The sugar addiction definitely was there from the first. Yeah.
And you also said, and this came early on, and tell me why it did, that early in your life, you decided that you would rather die than be fat.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I was always concerned very early on, so that by the time I was in my early 20s, I was exercising long before it was popular, long before there were gyms all over town, long before people were doing nothing but talking about aerobics and so on. I knew, and the thing was that I knew that I was like, when I exercised, I could manage my depression. I didn't know what to call this phenomenon, but of course it's endorphins. That's what it is. And so I had a lot of help in terms of my balancing my addictions and my alcoholism because I started exercising very early.
You went through so many different diets, and you must be the only person on this planet who's done such a thorough analysis of what people through history have had to say about diet. I mean, you go back to a Buddhist in China, 500 AD, you go back to Hippocrates and give us advice as to what he said about how to eat healthy foods.
Yes, most of these thoughtful, I would say, thoughtful, meditative intellectuals who thought enough about it, they must have had issues themselves with food. That's what I think connected all the stories of the diet gurus in the book. They were all people who had something going on that was mysterious to them, and they figured it out. They figured out it was the food. And whether they manifested it with depression or anxiety or weight or addiction to sugar or alcohol, they figured out that what goes in is what helps or doesn't help your mental and physical state. So Hippocrates, I quoted early about his feeling about, you know, food being essential, being essential to moderate.
Mm-hmm.
And then moving through history with Lord Byron, of course, and Banting, and even William the Conqueror, who didn't. He decided that he would address the fact that he couldn't get on his horse anymore, and that his nephew, his French, I guess he was a cousin, Philip, had noticed and said, "Oh, the king looks like he's pregnant," and of course that got his ego, and he went on a liquid diet. A lot of us, I don't know what kind of liquids he particularly drank, but I imagine everything but water, which meant they couldn't drink water in those days. You know, they really understood that it was not good for you. And so milk, I don't think it would have been, probably beer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people have gone on the beer diet.
Yes. Well, you remind us, when you think about how much money is spent, how huge this industry is, and you've probably purchased a fair number of books yourself, Judy, diet industry is huge in this country, always has been.
It always has been. And, you know, everybody's got a different idea, which is interesting. The one thing that the thread of truth that runs through all these diets is that they work for a while, and then they don't. And that's the problem. That's the problem that I ran into anyway. Also, that eating disorders include people who are obesely, who are morbidly obese, people that are obese, people that are anorexic, people that are bulimic, and everybody in between who wants to lose 10 to 30 pounds by Christmas. So we all fall into that category of what's the problem and then what's the solution.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to talk about my solution in the book and say, you know, actually, it's pretty scientific and pretty easy. And if you find some sort of place like an anonymous program where you've got other people doing the same thing, it doesn't cost anything. It's simple. You don't need special shoes. You don't need to pay, you know, $1,000 to join this particular program. You can, through simple application of brain power and a computer, find these locations of gatherings online, go to them, maybe put a dollar in the basket if it's live, but mainly get the information, which everybody is sharing. And I think it's very powerful. We follow the tenets of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which say that, in the doctor's opinion, that we have an illness, we're allergic to certain foods,
in alcohol, of course, but they're the same foods we can't eat. And they set up a compulsion and an allergy, a combination. Now, it's like a big jump because most doctors get about 4 hours of education in medical school about addiction. That's it.
Right.
And that's why most people don't think, they don't go to the area of allergy as a first choice and say, well, I'm not going to eat these things because I'm allergic, except if it's gluten. There's a big thing about gluten. Well, turns out that wheat, sugar, grains, flour, and corn, they all set up the addiction and the compulsion. So if you can get rid of those, you got a chance to lower your diabetic count, to lose your weight, get back into that swimsuit, and be happy and joyous.
Mm. And so you've been able to do that, and you feel markedly better?
Oh, my God.
Oh, yes, I guess I hear it in your voice.
You know, I have, first of all, I have no cravings. Number one. And really from the start, for about 36 years, I haven't really, except that I fooled around in the program that I was in because they thought you could make up your own food plan for a while. Well, you know how much we know about that. Well, we know everything about nutrition and nothing about sticking to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took me a long time, and 8.5 years ago is when I found this new, apparently difficult, on the surface, but when you get into it, you realize it's abundant food, it's 3 meals a day, it's 40 ounces of vegetables, it's proteins, you know, 4 ounces of protein at every meal, any kind of thing you want, salads, fruits. I mean, who could complain? And it's what your mother told you, 3 times a day, nothing in between, no snacks, no desserts.
Mm.
And the minute I got on this, the mind stopped rattling away with all of its ideas and talk and chatter. And I was already, well, I had gone back up to 140, which has always been my top weight, not to mention the 1,000 pounds I've taken off and gained over these many years. And suddenly I was free. And that's the wonderful thing. I don't have to argue in my mind, what shall I have? Shall I have it on Christmas? What do I do if I can't have some of the cake? I can't. No, I don't. The argument is over. The natter is over. There's peace and calm and tremendous energy. Of course, I take all these vitamins, which I highly recommend that people take the vitamins that they should. And I have tremendous energy, as you know. And as I know, and I'm grateful for. So I just thought, you know, let me just get this information out there because people are suffering and they don't need to.
And the book details to the point where you just really feel for you, Judy. You went through hell for such a long period of time. I mean, you almost lost this precious gift that you have, which is your voice, due to purging.
Yeah.
Isn't that traumatic?
Absolutely. Very traumatic. Purging and drinking, both the combination, and I was very, very lucky because I had a doctor, an ENT man in New York in 1977. When I was falling, my whole life was unraveling. I couldn't work. I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't stop eating. I couldn't stop purging. You know, and then you have to keep up that image, and I must have canceled 45, 50 concerts that year because I couldn't sing. On top of everything, I could not because I had this issue with my throat. And my doctor said, you know, I have discovered a laser surgery that might work. He said, I'm not going to make any promises. He said, if you don't have this, you're never going to sing again.
Oh, my.
And if you do have it, there's a chance. So what could I say? I had to say yes. And he did this in October 77 when I was really at the end and I hadn't worked for most of that year, and I wouldn't work again professionally for another year and a half. And it worked, and a few months later, I had the grace given to me to get sober. And, of course, sober, then I could deal with the food. Then I could get into a program. I could start really, you know, I could make the... You know, I wanted to walk in front of a bus is what I wanted to do. I was really suicidal with the food, even more so, I think, than with the alcohol. I think
really?
food I think food can make you crazy. Depression, despair, oh, the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was, today I got abstinent. It was funny because I've been purging for 11 years.
Goodness.
Almost without, well, with no conscious effort on my part to stop and no ability to stop.
Right.
And the next morning after I'd gotten this food plan that I'm telling you about now, I met with this woman, and that was when I was really, and I really did think I was going to walk in front. And I was sober, can you believe, and still behaving with this insane idea that was propelled by the bulimia, by the food addiction, by the craziness. And the next day, after she gave me all this information, I was abstinent from bulimia after 11 years of purging and decades of suffering with it. So it's a magical thing when you realize that the science is really working. You suddenly don't have those other foods in your mind, and you have a plan, and you have a buddy that you can talk to about
right.
this, and you have this entire universe on your side. Mm. And I don't care what you believe in, Buddha, God, angels, the river, the tree in your backyard, you know.
Your dog, your cat.
Your dog, your cat, and they're the best, you know. They're perhaps the preferable higher powers at times. And somehow, if you get the idea that you aren't in charge yourself, maybe you'll get lucky and see miracle happen. And I did, and that was 34, 35 years ago. Mm. So I haven't purged in many years, but I didn't have the clarity that came to me in 2008 until it arrived and until I surrendered and said, oh, I get it. I have to stay on this clear, clean path, and everything will be revealed.
Mm. A lot of the book, and your story is so interesting, the story with your dad and the pressure on you. You're a wonderful pianist, and the pressure to play these complicated pieces at a very young age. Your father was an alcoholic. You had this idyllic young life because you loved your family very much, but there were some serious problems. I'm wondering, when I read about your life, Judy, I think, the pressure that was on you led you, and perhaps your depression too, to commit suicide, try to commit suicide when you were 14
yeah.
years old. And I kept
yeah.
thinking in the whole reading of your story, thankful that you've found all this health now, but wondering if, you know, if there had been a therapist when you were 14, or if there had been an admission that alcoholism was going on in the family and we need to treat this, if something had been able to be there for you at an earlier age, would it have been a lifesaver?
Well, that's why I write about these taboos. That's why when I started to write memoir when I was in my late 20s, I started in my songbook to break open the secrets of my family, which is the trick. You have to be able to write the truth. And when I started to write the truth, I began to find a lot of things lifting, including the illnesses that were plaguing me and the confusion and fog of alcoholism. And my feeling, yes, I think knowing about these, I think for the 14-year-old in the world, for the many, many 14-year-olds who live in alcoholic families, you know, I was so touched. I went to Betty Ford a few years ago, and one of my friends was running it. She took over Mrs. Ford's office, actually, and she was there. And I had never visited the Betty Ford facility in what it was called, Rancho Mirage, I think they call it. And she said, well, why don't you come by? She wanted to come to the concert I was doing there. And then eventually she said, I want you to come and sing for our 30th anniversary, which I did. But that night we went over to, she said, I just want you to see the facility. And I had already been sober for a number of years, and I'd gotten sober out here in the East, down in Pennsylvania, Chit Chat. And she took me through this, and she said, then here's our children's section. Beautifully laid out, beautiful place. It's just for the children of alcoholics.
Mm.
And I began to weep
mm-hmm.
because I saw myself living down there on Mississippi Avenue in Los Angeles, West LA, with this drunken father, successful, brilliant man who was struggling with alcohol, staggering home at night from Hollywood, you know, with his suit rumpled and his hair this way and that. And he had no idea what he was up against, and we didn't have any idea. And we would have qualified, even if my parents had not been clients of Betty Ford, they could go there. I could go there as the child of an alcoholic. It's a family disease, and all of these addictions and so on have resonance within the family. And the children, like me, who chose to try to kill myself as a teenager, you know, we need to let people know that there are answers to these things, that actually there's treatment available, that, you know, this opiate play
horrible
is in the same boat. And, of course, now, I mean, they're talking about it at the White House a lot, and now Christie's going to be the head of the opiate squad.
Right.
But the main thing that they're saying, which is you cannot get rid of Medicare. If you do, you lose all the treatment that everybody knows, screaming and jumping up and down and saying, my son died, my nephew died, my neighbor's kid died. Half of the town is on these drugs, right, which come out of Big Pharma. A lot of this addiction comes from the things that we're allergic to, that we have addictions to, these horrible pills. We take them for pain, and then they give us a pain in the ass, you know? They give us carte blanche. They give us addiction. And then we have to turn, many of us, to street drugs because they're cheaper. So everything is tied up together. And as long as we have possible Medicare and other insurances to take care of getting treatment for some of these addictions, we can keep educating and we can keep letting people know that they are not alone as a 14 or 11 or 12-year-old. They do not have to take a bottle of pills. They do not have to jump out a window because they have an alcoholic family in which they're living and in which they're suffering.
Judy Collins is our guest this hour. Her latest book, she is a truth teller, as she said. She thought it important to tell the truth when she started writing about her life in her 20s. Her latest book is Judy Collins' Cravings, How I Conquered Food. It's a story of her problems with food over a number of years, purging to the point where she almost lost her gorgeous voice. It also deals with her life in the musical world, her marriage, her family, her alcoholism. She is incredibly forthright about all of that, and she is with us this hour. And, of course, it's Judy Collins, so we have to play a little music every now and then during this hour. Well, welcome phone calls. I'm sure that what she says resonates with many of you, and the fact that it is Judy Collins, who we think of as, and rightfully so, enormously successful, seems very composed, has had all these very serious issues in her life, makes her words perhaps more poignant. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, where we love to read your messages, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're weaving music in, as she does in her book. This is the song that had her move from classical piano to folk music, so we thought we'd play a little music along the way here. Here's Judy Collins.
The Gypsy Rover came over the hill, down through the valley so shady. He whistled and he sang till the greenwood rang, and he won the heart of a lady. Adi-do, adi-do, da-day, adi-do, la-di-day. He whistled and he sang till the greenwood rang, and he won the heart of a lady. What I'll give you since you've asked is all my time together. Take the rugged sunny days, the warm and rocky weather. Take the roads that I have walked along, looking for tomorrow's time, peace of mind.
Judy Collins and a song that she wrote, Since You Asked. She's with us talking about her latest book, Cravings, How I Conquered Food. I do want to ask you some musical questions along the way. You wrote that song. You made so many people's careers, but you took up songwriting at what point, Judy? And obviously, you're meant to be a writer. Look how many books you've written.
I was not writing songs in 1966 when I started to record my sixth album, which was called In My Life. And I'd made five albums for Elektra. Most of them were folk or what I call the city singers, Dylan, Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, even Dick Farina. But I was working on In My Life, and I brought in Josh Rifkin to do orchestral versions of a kind of jumping ship and doing another kind of song. I was recording, In My Life, for instance, different sort of thing. And the songs from the Mara Saad, which was in production in New York, as well as Pirate Jenny from the Three Penny Opera. And they were orchestrated. So this is a big jump for me, although I didn't realize how big. And about the time I was just about ready to release this, I got a call from my friend. Her name is Mary Martin, not the one who flies, but another Mary Martin. And she and I knew each other for a couple of years, and she used to always talk about this obscure poet in Canada named Leonard. And she went to school with him. She went to McGill, so she knew him very, very well, and they were bosom buddies. And she said, she would talk about his poetry and how wonderful he was and so on. And one day she called me and she said, well, Leonard now wants to come to New York and play you his song. Now, I've always thought that one of the reasons, well, the main reason was that I had already recorded a number of songs by other writers that I had helped to make famous, more famous, I would say. So he knew that he couldn't take his songs, and he wasn't singing in public. He wouldn't sing in public. And he wanted to be the man behind the hit maker. So he wanted to get the songs to people, to somebody who didn't write songs, and I was that person. And I had already kind of proven myself as able to do that. I had a record label that was behind me. I was eclectic, and I was the perfect kind of fit for him, and he knew that. He figured that out, so he came to me, and the first thing he said was, I can't sing, and I can't play the guitar, and I don't know if this is a song. And then he sang me Suzanne.
Oh.
So this was a love affair made somewhere. Thank God it wasn't a romance. It was just a love affair with his songs. And he came and he sang me the songs. I recorded them. He said, you're making me famous, which I was. I did. I kept writing, but recording his songs for years. Even on my last album, next to last album, on Strangers Again, I recorded, which I had never done, the song that so many people recorded. But I had started, of course, with Suzanne. And after about half a year, I pushed him on stage at a Fillmore benefit I was doing in New York for WBAI, Pacifica radio station. And I made him sing. I mean, I got him out there and made him sing Suzanne, because I told him that I'd made him famous, and now he had to prove that he could sing those songs. And he said, I'm not doing that. And then he finally succumbed. And when he got out there, he stopped in the middle of the concert. And he said, I can't go on. He walked off, and everybody went crazy. You know, said, oh, come back. And so I said, well, I'll go back out with you, which I did. And then he finished the song. And then, of course, he always, from that point on, always sang his song. Then, just after that, he called me and he said, I love that you're recording my songs. Obviously, you've made me famous, his words. So, but I don't understand why you're not writing your own songs.
Oh.
At which point, I mean, when Leonard says something, you listen.
Right.
And whether he says something in person, on the phone, or from wherever he is now, you listen. And so I went home, and I sat down, and I wrote. That was my first song since that. And I have continued to write. I mean, it's a mind-boggling thing that he and I did so much for one another, that we traded good suggestions and good influence one to the other. I mean, that's very rare, actually.
And they're such big things that you got him to sing his songs, and he got you to write.
Yeah. I mean, that's phenomenal. So I have this huge collection of songs. I'm writing more today than I ever wrote before. And I just got a Grammy for songs that I co-wrote with someone. I'd never would have done that if it hadn't been that Leonard asked me that question.
Hmm. I love that story. All right, let's go to some phone calls. We have many coming in. Judy Collins is our guest, and we start with Larry in Stevens Point. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Judy. I'm tickled pink to talk to you real quickly here. I'm your age, so I kind of grew up with your music, but I did not realize how special it was to me until this last year when I saw, I think it was American Masters show on you. And at that point in time, I decided that you were going to sing at my memorial service, whenever that is.
Oh.
And it'd be Amazing Grace. Can you recommend a particular version that you think is special?
Well, I recorded it in 1970 on an album called Whales and Nightingales, and that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. It's not bad. Yeah, it's more than pretty good. I interviewed you some years ago after one of your other books, and I've told so many people this story, Judy, that I used to do this religious show. I was a young woman who got hired because I was a woman for another radio station in town, and they gave me this 7 to 8 o'clock Sunday morning and said, we got to fulfill the FCC requirement for religion, so the show is yours. I said, okay. I had no idea what to do. So I played a lot of folk music, and I played Amazing Grace, your version, almost every Sunday. And I told you about this when you were in Milwaukee, and you know what you did? You sat just very close to me, and you sang the song to me, and I was just, I've told so many people that story. It was just such a generous thing. So any version
so
you do
bad.
Is okay. Yeah. That's great. Larry, thank you very much for your call. Julia is next in Madison. Hi, Julia.
Hi. Judy, I'm glad that you made something out of your life and that you're successful. I come from a family where alcoholism is very prevalent, and both my parents were alcoholics. However, I don't think it's the big pharmacy's responsibility, or is it the people who make alcohol? It is our choice to drink or to not drink, to pick up that pill or not pick up that pill. And addiction is a disease, and I agree, it's a family disease. I've tried to kill myself multiple times until I got help.
Yeah.
So I just really do not appreciate people blaming it on something than the person themselves. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm the youngest of 9 siblings, and I have other siblings who are alcoholics and who are not. It is a genetic disease for a large part. So please don't blame the pharmacies or the people who make alcohol. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I will say that, of course, and I will emphasize that our caller is right. It is certainly a disease, and it is certainly the responsibility of our individual, chances, grace, whatever it is, to find a way through. However, having said that, there are about 10% of us in this country who are alcoholics, and 2% of us get any chance for treatment because of a lack of knowledge and a lack of information. Doctors are at fault in many, many ways because they don't understand. And as I said before, somewhere today, and I will say it again, doctors get about 4 hours of education on addiction, and that's it in medical school. There are a few little pockets where people like Hazelden try to school doctors about addiction. But even the AMA in 1955 said, we can't handle it. We don't know what it is. Alcoholics Anonymous knows, but we don't. And the big pharma companies in this country have us over a barrel. And one of the things that's going on is that opiates have been handed out by big pharma to the doctors to hand to their clients. And addiction can stem from having too many of those, I won't use the expletive, pills in our hands, in our pockets, in our little bottles, and very little education about how to use them. So it is true that education on alcoholism and food addiction and opiate addiction is essential. If we don't get the word out to let people know they have an illness that can be cured and brought to a screeching halt, and there are certain areas in the country, in the world, that can help you do that. And if you go online and look at anonymous programs, you'll find hundreds of them for all kinds of issues. So it's a combination of things, and we do want to treat the illness, and we do want to support the individual, and we do want to take the organizations that get us into this trouble to task so that they're educated. That's what we need. Between the big pharma and the insurance companies, we are up against it. And by all means, talk about it and let people know what you feel.
Right.
That's the best.
Yeah. I'm wondering how far we've come, because it was amazing to me to read. You went to many doctors for your problems. You know, you were blacking out at some point, and a lot of the doctors that you sought treatment from thought your drinking was just fine. It might help you, right?
Oh, and they said, how could you be an alcoholic? Look at how successful you are. And,
right,
of course, at the time that I was going down in flames, I had Grammys, I had million-dollar sellers, I had top 10 records.
Right.
I had just had a top 10 record with the Sin and the Clowns in 77,
mm-hmm,
when I was totally unable to work. So, no, they didn't know. I finally found a doctor who did understand, and he said, you have an illness, you have a disease. I didn't know it was a disease. I don't think most people understand that alcoholism is, as the lady who just spoke said, an illness, and it's rampant in families, and it's rampant in this country. So,
yes, it is.
We need to be educated. We need to know that there's a resource, that we can get treatment, that we can find the answer to these problems.
Our number is 800-486-8655. Judy Collins is our guest in her latest book. She's a beautiful writer, and she writes just so completely honestly. It takes you back every now and then, and you appreciate the fact that she's so remarkably honest about her conquering food. She also deals with alcoholism. She deals with suicide, thinking about suicide, attempting suicide in her life. Some of the life on the road, also her successes in the music world. It's a biography in addition to looking very extensively at food addiction and how it almost ruined her voice. So we welcome calls. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655. She mentioned Leonard Cohen and all that he had done for her to get her to write songs, and she to get him to sing music. And she mentioned the song Suzanne, and I was itching to play it then, but I waited until now. So here's a little bit of Judy Collins and Leonard Cohen.
Now Suzanne takes your hand, she leads you to the river. She's wearing rags and feathers from Salvation Army counters, and the sun pours down like honey on Our Lady of the Harbor. And she shows you where to look amid the garbage and the flowers. There are heroes in the seaweed, there are children in the morning. They are leaning out for love, and they will lean that way forever, while Suzanne holds the mirror. And you want to travel with her, you want to travel blind, and you know she will find you, for she's touched your perfect body with her mind.
Judy Collins is our guest this hour, and her latest book is Cravings, How I Conquered Food. And we go to more phone calls for her. Ray in Rhinelander is next. Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Hi.
Judy, thank you for everything you've done for all of us with your music and your support through the decades. And I agree with just about everything that you're presenting here today. I worked for many years in drug and alcohol rehab. I also ran inpatient units and detox centers. I did the full gamut for many, many years. the whole thing is one of the problems nowadays in this country is that people don't realize that you can't just dry somebody out, so to speak, and then put them back in the street. They have to go through a program of breaking down what was going on in their lives, et cetera, emotionally, spiritually, and what was lacking, et cetera, their life experiences, and to build them back up with the confidence that they have a free will choice, as also surrendering it up to a higher power. I've seen a lot of programs come and go, but I really support the 12 step because it's very realistic and it's very applicable, and it shows that they can take responsibility for the disease and recover and move on and let go. And the problem in this country right now is that you have people that are strung out on all these things, but they end up going into jail and then back on the streets again with maybe a couple rehab things. We had a lot more rehab support back in the 80s, especially. The 80s was the hub is when I was in it.
In the 80s, I got sober in 78. You're absolutely right. The heyday of the straightforward, let's get to the bottom of this, let's use the 12-step programs, rehabs, happened in that 10-year period. And you're right, it's being disabled in many ways by a lot of factors, one of which is the collusion between the drug companies and the insurance company. Nowadays, you must, in many places, and now I think Suboxone is required in some of these treatment centers up in the Northeast, you have to be treated by, you have to have a medical diagnosis and therefore receive some sort of medication. Suboxone is one of the popular ones.
Yes.
Before your insurance can turn on. This is an insane combination that's going on. Yes, it does get some people into treatment, but it does produce other problems. You're right, it was the heyday. It was old school, and I totally agree with you. So you have people must find a way back through their problems. And that's how you know you don't go around it, you go through it. And you hopefully learn tools that make you. You know, they say when you get sober, I was 38 when I got sober, and I was really 15 when I started drinking. So they say you go back to the age you were when you started drinking. I hate to say it, but that's probably the truth, and I'm probably really only 39 years old, which is good news.
And a lot of people would say you look it, too, so you got some secret there.
Well, thank God.
Ray, thanks so much for the call. Katie in New Glarus, hi.
Hi there. I have a neighbor, a 13-year-old neighbor, who her father is an alcoholic, and she has a very volatile relationship with her mother. And she comes to my house quite often to seek some just a place to escape to. And we've gotten to talking, and recently she's been bringing up the idea of suicide, which really, really concerns me. And I'm wondering if you have anything, a book or anything that you can recommend that I have her read. I'm trying to give her my own personal support and talk through things with her, but I would like to be able to give her something a little more tangible.
You know, I don't know anything about prevention, but I have written a book about suicide called Sanity and Grace. It's a seductive idea to people who have the ideology. Perhaps there is some sort of group in town, SOS, is one, survivors of suicide, but I can't really tell you. You might want to go online and look to see if there's any support system and offer that up to her, some group that's her age group to go to. I mean, God, I mean, if I'd had a therapy to talk to therapist at 13, it might have saved mine. I think it would have destroyed my family if I'd succeeded in my attempt, I think. So I don't know. It's a tough one. Ed, the main thing is to find out what's online for support in your neighborhood in Wisconsin. Or I think that's where you live.
Yes.
And see if you can get some positive input. Now, one of the things that's helpful, I think, about talking. When I do my talks to suicide prevention groups, I talk about the even if you're an alcoholic family, even if you're in a dreadful situation, the center of the world is you. So what do you do to get yourself mentally and physically healthy? You exercise, you eat right, you meditate, you find people that you can talk to, and you're serving a purpose for this girl, no question about it, because one of the main things is having somebody to talk to about this stuff. And you are doing a great service. You're an angel to her. And I hope that can continue. The positive aspects. What's positive in her life? Does she love to play sports? Does she have any interest in writing or painting or making music? You know, my music probably saved my life through those years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the essential question is how you get your own psyche with the things that have been given to us, which are free, like the air and the water. Well, in most places, the water. And most places, the air.
Right.
How do we get ourselves connected to the values and qualities that are going to be healing for us? Go to have a massage. Get yourself a, go to a, you know, go to do Pilates. Go to do Alexander. Something that can ground you and yet let you fly.
Mm-hmm. And if you want Katie to give an email or something to Colleen, I'll put you on hold because I'm sure there are people in the New Glarus area who are listening who might be able to guide your neighbor to a specific resource. So let me do that, okay? We don't want to just leave this here. We'll try and guide you to somebody in your community. Thanks very much for your call. Judy Collins is our guest. Anne in Madison, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Judy. When I was 19 years old, someone told me that I looked like Judy Collins, and I don't know where I had my head, but I didn't really know popular music. I didn't know who sang what. I didn't know the words to any of the songs. So I went and looked, and I found one of your albums, and I just thought you were beautiful, and I thought that it was a compliment. And so, I've grown up since then listening to you and really enjoying you, and it's a pleasure to hear you today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Are you taking care of yourself?
Yes, I have a cold. Yeah. I'm home with a cold today, but yes.
Well, rest. You have plenty of rest. A lot of water.
You drink a lot of water, right. Thanks so much, Anne, for your call. And let's go to Margaret in Sun Prairie. Just about a minute left. Margaret, hi.
Well, hello, Judy. I'm so happy to hear you. You were a great influence on me in my youth, and back in 69 was when I think I first heard you, and I would sing all your songs, like, you know, Goes and Froes of Angel Hair and Liverpool Lullaby.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh.
Have a songbook of yours from way back then. I probably came from a dysfunctional family, and at age 65, I was diagnosed with bipolar.
Mm.
And I also have a eating problem, but it's the other spectrum of yours. And I guess I would like to know if there are some places in Madison that I could probably get.
Yeah. Judy, you should read Judy's book, certainly. Anybody who's struggled with this issue should read this. And I will have to leave it at that because we're almost out of time, unless you have an easy place for her to go, Judy.
Go to the index in my book and go online and look up Greyshet, Greyshet.
Okay, and you'll find Judy's answer. What a pleasure to speak with you, and thanks for writing. I really loved your book.
I'm so glad.
Yeah, thank you very much, Judy, for being with us.
Thanks for having me on your show. I'm delighted to see and talk to you again.
Yeah, great to talk to you. Judy Collins, her latest book is Cravings, How I Conquered Food. And that's that. Thanks so much to Natalie Guyette for producing this interesting hour. And thanks to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks to Judy Collins for her honesty and for being with us this hour.